It's Friday, January 31, 2014. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. News came down late yesterday that the Justice Department has announced that it will seek the death penalty against Jokhar Tsarnaev. The now 20-year-old young man, the prosecutors claim, had masterminded the bombing at the Boston Marathon along with his older brother, who died just days after the bombing. That bombing killed three people and injured more than 200 others. It is described as one of the worst terrorist incidents in the United States since the attacks of September the 11th, 2001. The most interesting aspect of this is that the Justice Department has decided and has now announced that it will seek the death penalty. That was in question because the Attorney General of the United States, Eric Holder, is a decided opponent of the death penalty itself. So what's really interesting here is that the United States Attorney General, Eric Holder, an opponent of the death penalty, has nonetheless announced that the Justice Department, under his leadership, will seek the death penalty in its prosecution of Jokhar Tsarnaev. Yesterday, the Attorney General said, quote, after consideration of the relevant facts, the applicable regulations, and the submissions made by the defendant's counsel, I have determined that the United States will seek the death penalty in this matter. The nature of the conduct at issue and the resultant harm compel this decision, end quote. As CNN reported yesterday, the announcement ends months of speculation over the issue. Tsarnaev and his brother Tamerlan, who was killed in a shootout with police in April of last year, constructed and set off homemade bombs near the finish line of the Boston Marathon. Tsarnaev faces 30 counts in the bombing, including the use of a weapon of mass destruction, resulting in death and the bombing of a public place. Very interesting fact, CNN reports, since 1964, the United States government has only executed three people. One of them was also convicted of domestic terrorism. That was Timothy McVeigh, who was convicted in the 1995 bombing of the Federal Center in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Let's step back for a moment and consider what's at stake here. The death penalty is described as the ultimate penalty, and we understand that. It's described as capital punishment because by the use of the word capital, it makes very clear that it is a punishment unto death. It is a controversial issue in America. Fewer and fewer crimes are now assigned the death penalty, and the death penalty is actually operational in fewer and fewer jurisdictions. And there are places in America where the death penalty is so supported by public sentiment that prosecutors seek it in almost every applicable capital murder case. And what we have is a great cultural divide in America, and we shouldn't be surprised by that. It exists on abortion, it exists on issues of sexuality and marriage, and it exists also on the death penalty. It is worth noting that the death penalty divide does not have an exact overlay with those other issues. As a matter of fact, among younger Americans, support for the death penalty is fast evaporating. From a Christian worldview perspective, there's a lot in play here. First of all, you have the Noahic covenant found in Genesis 9, where God himself said to Noah that if a person commits murder by human hands, his life is to be forfeited. But the Bible also makes clear that the death penalty, as the ultimate sanction, is to be brought only when there is adequate witness evidence that is brought forward, a very technical issue with a very high level of expectation in the Scripture. We also have in the Scripture those who did take human life, including Moses and Saul, later Paul, who are not executed for their murder or complicity in murder. David would also have to be added to that list. We have the situation that the death penalty nonetheless answers a deep, very deep, human need, the drive for ultimate justice for ultimate crimes, the crime of homicide in particular. The Tsarnaev brothers are now accused of killing three people and injuring 200 others and trying to do maximum mayhem in the concluding moments of the Boston Marathon last year. And now you have Eric Holder, the Attorney General of the United States, who is a foe of the death penalty, who either by political pressure or by moral force of argument simply had to bring, or in this case found it expedient to bring, the death penalty in the case of Jokhar Tsarnaev. So what do we learn from this? Well, we learn at least this. Even in a nation deeply divided over the death penalty, even in a situation where the Attorney General of the United States is a decided opponent of the death penalty, under his own leadership, the United States government is seeking the death penalty for this case. This is where the situation becomes very clear to us. If the death penalty is applicable in any single case, under any conceivable circumstances, then the death penalty itself is a legitimate penalty. The question is not whether it's legitimate, but how it is legitimately applied. In other words, the Attorney General of the United States has helped us, inadvertently, probably in this case, help us to see that the question really is how the death penalty should be legitimately applied. Even he, in this case, if he's not merely operating out of political hypocrisy, and we should hope that he is not, is saying that there are cases where even the opponent of the death penalty believes that it is legitimate. We have to turn that around, don't we? There are also cases where supporters of the death penalty have to understand that it isn't appropriate, even where there could be some moral instinct that it is. That's where it takes the ultimate concern of a functioning justice system to do its very best to execute justice. It's a reminder to us that human justice at its very best is penultimate, that is, it never reaches ultimate justice. But it also reminds us that we have to do the very best we can to achieve justice. And in light of the bombings at the Boston Marathon, even the Attorney General of the United States, an opponent of the death penalty, said it is the death penalty he will seek in this case. That tells us all something. CNN is out with a report in the middle of this week, along with others in the major media, and they're announcing a stem cell breakthrough. The headline in CNN by Elizabeth Landau is this: stem cell breakthrough may be simple, fast, cheap. Those are words not necessarily long associated with stem cell research. That's not even why we're talking about it on today's edition of The Briefing. We're talking about it because in the case of this report in CNN, in the New York Times, the Washington Post, Scientific American, and so many others, what we have here is a refutation of what mainstream science claimed was absolute just a matter of a few years ago, a few months ago, even before this report, a few days ago. The most important aspect of this release on stem cell research goes back to 2001. Back in 2001, just days before those terrorist attacks on Washington and New York on September the 11th, then-President George W. Bush held a nationally televised speech to the nation in which he handed down America's first federal regulations and guidelines on stem cell research. And what we were told then, not by the president, but by the scientific establishment, was that the only way to get stem cells that would be viable for human research, for medical breakthroughs, would be to create and then to destroy human embryos in order to get those stem cells. It was an argument that lacked moral and scientific credibility even then. As a matter of fact, the most successful uses of human stem cells in any kind of practical therapeutic application have come from so-called adult stem cells. Let's just remind ourselves of what we're talking about. Stem cells are particular kinds of human cells. They are the cells that eventually develop into the specialized tissues that make up our body. Stem cells become bone, others become muscles, others become brain, others become hearts. All the parts of our body originate in these stem cells. Given the fact that we live in a Genesis 3 world with injury and with disease and all kinds of syndromes, there is great potential in the fact that we can program these stem cells to actually regrow or repair damaged organs, damaged tissues. There are amazing things that could well result from stem cell research. But the insistence of the scientific community that this would require the wanton destruction of human embryos was one of the signs of our time that the sanctity of human life was being subverted right before our eyes. Even then, back in 2001, it was known that adult stem cells existed. That is, stem cells that aren't taken from an embryo that has to be destroyed, but rather stem cells taken from human beings after they are alive. The use of the word adult doesn't necessarily mean it's in a fully grown human being, but a human being after birth. There are all kinds of things that occur in the background of this, but what's most important is that this headline story, carried in virtually all the major media in the nation this week, tells us that all along, the human embryo did not have to be destroyed in order for this very promising medical experimentation to continue. What we know now is that the antipathy to the embryo and the discounting of human life was unnecessary from the start. We should celebrate this news release. It is good news for those who have diseases such as Parkinson's and diabetes and so many others who may have burns that stem cell research may eventually be able to heal, who have organs that may eventually be repaired. This is good news. It's wonderful news. But it's also chastening news. Just because the medical community says we have to destroy the embryo in order to get this medical result doesn't mean it's true. It never was true. And even if it was true, does the automatic answer to that become the destruction of one human life to save another? The very complex of this question reminds us of just how problematic some of these medical issues can be, and just how false even a scientific consensus that's announced by the media could have been all along. On the issue of the sanctity of human life, Reuters is out with a very important story. It's a chastening story. It's one of those stories that will disappoint us, and yet it tells us something we need to know. The headline in this story from Reuters is this, quote, "Seeing ultrasound rarely changes abortion plans," according to study. As is reported in this article, nearly 99% of women went ahead with an abortion after voluntarily viewing an ultrasound image of the fetus beforehand, according to a large new U.S. study. End quote. Okay, that's the first sentence. That's all we know at this point. What does that tell us? Well, actually, it tells us nothing until you look deeper into the story. Here's the second paragraph. Quote, based on medical records for more than 15,000 women seeking abortion at Los Angeles Planned Parenthood clinics, researchers found that only a small fraction of the women changed their minds after seeing the image. End quote. What does that second paragraph tell us? The women who are being discussed here are the women who were already in a Planned Parenthood abortion clinic seeking an abortion. This doesn't tell us that 99% of all women considering abortion, once they see the ultrasound, go ahead with the abortion. It tells us that 99% of the women who are already inside a Los Angeles area Planned Parenthood abortion clinic go forward with the abortion, even after seeing the ultrasound, at least according to the study. One of the authors of the study, Katrina Kimport, at the University of California, San Francisco School of Medicine, said, quote, this study was motivated in large part by the current political and popular interest in what role ultrasound viewing plays in women's decisions about abortion, end quote. According to Reuters, 10 states have enacted laws that require doctors to perform ultrasounds before abortions, and 3 of those require the woman to view the image during the ultrasound. The others require doctors to offer women the option of viewing it. The doctor here in this case, the medical professor, again, her name is Katrina Kimport, said, quote, we were interested in bringing in an imperial perspective to these conversations, end quote. Well, if they were really interested in an imperial dimension to this conversation, they might have considered how to get a broader sampling of women seeking or considering an abortion. By the time a woman is inside a Los Angeles area Planned Parenthood abortion clinic, she has, probably for all intents and purposes, already made the decision to get the abortion. And yet, before we discount this study altogether, we should probably note something else. Several years ago, Time magazine had a cover story on the issue of abortion and the ultrasound, and the whole point of that cover story in Time magazine was that abortions were beginning to fall off largely because of the moral impact of the ultrasound image, as more and more Americans, younger and older, but especially younger, were seeing ultrasound images of their little brothers and sisters as they saw them take to the refrigerator and as they saw them routinely. There was a drop-off that was noticeable in terms of a woman's willingness to have an abortion. As a matter of fact, in the very memorable expression given by one pro-abortion feminist, quote, the fetus beat us. And what they meant by that was, once the fetus is seen, the desire for an abortion, the demand for an abortion, falls off significantly. So if it was true then, is it false now? Well, we don't know that, because this study actually, when you look at the research base, doesn't tell us enough to tell us that. But what if it's true? What would that tell us? Well, it would tell us something that we already know is true. Human beings have a way of overcoming moral defenses. Human beings intent on certain actions over time will overcome what ethicist Leon Cass calls the yuck factor. Human beings may have their moral sensitivities changed for some time by looking at an ultrasound image, but in the culture of death and in the increasing subversion of human dignity, it may well be that the moral impact of that ultrasound image fades or decreases over time. I sincerely hope not, but I am not actually confident that it's so, that that decrease cannot happen. I'm fairly confident that this study from this particular sample in Los Angeles area Planned Parenthood clinics doesn't tell us that, but maybe Genesis 3 already told us that, and that's the truly haunting reality. Meanwhile, at the intersection of confusion over sexuality and gender comes another very important headline, this one from a recent edition of the Wall Street Journal. The headline is this, quote, California law gives new options to transgender students, end quote. The article makes very clear that these new laws granting options for transgender students in states such as Massachusetts and California are intended to say to those kids who are claiming a transgender status, to be now living as the opposite of the gender that was assigned to them biologically at birth, that these kids now have the right to demand to have access to the bathrooms and the locker rooms of the sex they now claim rather than the sex they were originally assigned. The point of the Wall Street Journal is that states such as Massachusetts and California, their clearest focus is on California, are saying that those students have new options. They can demand access to the bathrooms, access to the locker rooms, etc. But the interesting part of this article in the Wall Street Journal is just how hard it actually is for even the states that want to pull this off to actually make it happen. In other words, how do you actually, programmatically, practically, make this kind of thing happen? How do you have a 16-year-old who was before a boy and is now supposed to be recognized as a girl to have access to the girls' locker room and the girls' restrooms? As the Wall Street Journal article makes very clear, the proponents of these new laws argue that justice requires and fairness requires that transgender students be able to enter into the facilities of the gender they choose to identify with, not the one with which they were originally defined. And yet now you have a pushback. And the Wall Street Journal article makes very clear that pushback is even for a repeal of these laws, even in liberal states like California, because there are those who are saying that the children who are not transgender also have rights and that fairness is also an issue that is applicable to them to have someone who was biologically born the opposite sex to have access to the bathrooms where they will be and the locker rooms where they will change and the athletic teams on which they will play, that is also unjust and unfair. So what we have here, whether or not the Wall Street Journal recognizes it or not, is the classic collision of arguments for justice, for fairness. Here you have people saying it's only fair that those transgender students have access to the facilities and the teams, the locker rooms, the bathrooms, and the athletic teams of those that are now populated by the sex with which they identify, rather than the sex with which they were born. But fairness arguments come from the other side, saying it's only fair that students who are girls or students who are boys have the right to enter into a locker room made up of other boys and other girls, respectively, where they do not have persons who were biologically born of the opposite sex inflicted upon them in terms of their presence in a locker room or a bathroom or on an athletic team. It's a very interesting collision. It's one of those that our late modern age now forces upon us. But it also points to something else, doesn't it? Something that's very important to the Christian worldview. Fairness and justice are not the same thing. There are so many who want fairness, but what we should actually seek is justice. It's kind of like the Christian worldview when it comes to happiness and joy. Happiness is just not enough. That's a superficial, ephemeral thing. Joy is what is based in truth. Justice is based in the character of God. Fairness is a human equation that tries to come up with something that might work in the ethics of the sandbox, but it doesn't work in the most intractable problems of human morality. And let's face it, the question of confusion over sexuality and gender isn't something that is going to be adjudicated in the playground. It isn't something that's going to be really argued out in the sandbox. Fairness isn't going to work. So the Wall Street Journal is writing an article about the legal complexities of states like Massachusetts and California, trying to say this is the way it's going to be, even as those who actually have to conduct and supervise these things are saying, we're not even sure how to comply with these laws. We're not even sure what this is going to look like and if it will work. But the Wall Street Journal is pointing to something deeper. And that is that fairness just isn't enough. Incommensurate arguments for fairness in collision, well, they really don't lead to much. They lead to just greater confusion. One parent saying this is fair for my child, the other saying this is fair for my child. Fairness doesn't work. Justice is different and is altogether superior. Justice is rooted in God as an attribute of God himself. Justice is revealed in his word, which after all doesn't really point to the necessity of any imperative of human fairness, but rather the desire and the mandate to achieve, as close as we can, the actual achievement of justice. In other words, what we have is a lesson from the Wall Street Journal. We should have known it all along. Arguments for fairness will run into inevitable collision that can never be negotiated. Arguments for justice, that requires it looking deeper than just mere human fairness. And in this case, it simply points to the truth that if you rebel against the very structure of God's creation, you're not going to be able to achieve justice, whether you recognize it as justice or try to call it fairness. Finally, let me remind you that tomorrow brings the first release of a brand new program, Ask Anything Weekend Edition. I'm really excited about this, and I'm really pleased that so many of you have already called with your questions. Good questions. Questions we'll discuss tomorrow and in weeks to come. This program goes all the way back to the Albert Mohler radio program and Ask Anything Wednesday. It turned out that was the favorite day of the week for the audience and for me as well. We want your questions in your voice. Give us a call at 877-505-2058. That's 877-505-2058. Remember, tomorrow morning, where you receive the briefing, you'll also find Ask Anything Weekend Edition. Join the conversation. Until then, thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmohler.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Mohler. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, go to boycecollege.com. This weekend, I'll be speaking at the Gospel at Work Conference in Raleigh-Durham, North Carolina, and on Saturday and Sunday, preaching the services at the Summit Church, also in Raleigh-Durham. Perhaps I'll get a chance to see some of you there. I'll meet you on Monday for the briefing.